It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new survey says that a whole lot of Americans don't trust the media, and as a country, we stand out compared to dozens of others surveyed. We'll find out why that may be and what can be done about it coming up. First, a huge jump in the cost of lumber has had a big impact on construction projects around the country. While first-time home buyers are among those feeling the pinch, organizations that build housing for low-income families have been hit especially hard. While the price of lumber seems to be cooling off some, it's still a tough market for construction projects that are in the works. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been affected by the cost of construction materials as a homeowner, a home buyer, or home builder? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. In a bit, we'll talk to a pair of reporters who have followed this issue around the country. First, we talk to a Wisconsin-based organization that's feeling the impact of the high cost of lumber. Cora Halthofterhide is executive director of the Greater Green Bay Habitat for Humanity. Cora, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, before we get into the high cost of building materials, Cora, can you tell us about what kind of project you usually do and how many you usually do in a normal year?
In a normal year, our affiliate in Greater Green Bay does to between 7 and 9 homes on an average each year. And we also run a 24,000 square foot restore, which we just happened to put a brand new one in December of 2019 and had to shut it down 4 months later because of COVID. So it was the first time we had purchased this building because we had continued to pay rent for over 10 years and made that decision in 2019 to purchase a new facility.
And did the pandemic, Cora, kind of shut down your regular work as far as home building?
Absolutely. We had to close it down. Obviously, we depend solely on, I have two construction team members that work for us on our salary and our payroll, but the other ones are dedicated volunteers, and they have, 15 to 20 years experience, each one of them, and each one of them come 3 days a week or 2 days a week and literally are the backbone, or literally are the foundation of the organization on the build site.
And now here you are hoping to catch up in 2020. And as we'll hear in a minute, we'll find out why the price of lumber went up. But it did go up along with other construction materials. How big a problem has that been for you?
It's incredible. Not only is it the cost of our goods, but also the appraised values of homes today are completely out of whack where they were from 18 months ago. We have families that are approved. Our families in our affiliate are approved well over a year in advance so they can work towards their sweat equity hours, which they have to put in order to be able to take on the mortgage that they will take on with the Habitat home. But they also have to have sweat equity hours, and that also stopped. So it really, we have a commitment that they have to partner with us, and we weren't even able to get to 3 to 4 homes last year and service the needs. So we really had to make some changes, stop in our tracks, and then we're just now getting into full operation in June of this year with opening up the doors, because a lot of corporations, a lot of manufacturers, a lot of people want to come out and have a team building day at Habitat site. You're doing good for your community. You're also learning a trade. And it's really a great team building, and we've lost all of that last year. So we're just starting to get back in the, being able to allow that in our organization.
Who are you serving? Who's the target audience when you're building these houses? And then, of course, the families themselves helping build these houses.
It's the low to moderate income family, and they go through a rigorous, a vetting process, because they have to have the ability to pay. They have to have a certain income level. We walk off 23% of, the HUD guidelines is what they will pay for the home here in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and that's what it's set at off there. So we know that it used to be the low to moderate income. I think we're going to have to start trending up to the moderate income, because the low just can't afford the prices of an appraised value of the homes today. What once was $100,000 is now $160,000 and $180,000 just in 18 months. And it's just, it just takes some of those people right out of our equation. The other thing that's hurt too is on this, when we talk about lumber, and you know, they're somewhat stabilizing now, but all supplies were impacted because of the growth and the impact and the demand on housing. So we may have to switch. You know, we may be using a widget for a certain type of a plumbing fixture, an OBS board, or you know, trusses you can't mess with too much. But I mean, we may have to take a different size or a different, or react to what's in the market or, and you know, on the chain right now, and not be able to go back to what we were able to do. So we got a cookie cutter of houses that we use. You know, we use four or five different model homes, and you know, that's really how we operate. And our motto is really to keep everything. I mean, it's a simple, decent, and affordable home. There's not, you know, we're not looking at, you know, inlaid glass. Or, I mean, we build a basic home for our families. And you'd think they were getting a mansion, but they know they have a mortgage that goes along with it as well.
Before I let you go, Cara, you mentioned the ReStore, and I've shopped at Habitat ReStores before. I'm curious what the flow of stuff on your sales floor is, because I know a lot of people were purging and getting rid of lots of things. And maybe, I know I donated some things, for example, to ReStore, but there's a lot of demand for the stuff. Is there stuff on your shelves?
Absolutely. Our sales floor, we happen to hit, you know, they say location, and we picked a very visible location in Green Bay on the east side of town, and hold just some, you know, major discounters or department stores that are, I should say, big box stores that are still successful and running, open and running. And we were able to purchase at a warehouse that's almost 25,000 square feet, and our business has been phenomenal. With the exception of the 8 weeks we had to close down last year, we're on target to, you know, so people giving to us doesn't necessarily have to be money. If they give us, you know, gently used furniture, light fixtures, building supplies. So we did, I must say, if there had to be a shining star in this year, it was the uptick of our ReStore and our move to own our own business, our own building. So there was a positive sign in there, and we will continue to stress that, you know, donating to Habitat doesn't have to be, it can be your time, your talent, your finances, but also your stuff that you're kind of done with for a while. We love it.
Cara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was my pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
Cara Hult-Ofterhide is Executive Director of the Greater Green Bay Habitat for Humanity. She joined us to talk about the rising cost of lumber and how it impacts her organization's projects. Now we'll turn to the national scene. Marcy Nicholson is a reporter for Bloomberg based in Canada. Marcy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Sarah Holder is a writer for Bloomberg City Lab, focused on urban politics, housing, and work. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Marcy, can you tell us a little bit about the why? Why did we see this big boom in the price of lumber? And it's, as our last guest mentioned, tapering off some now. What's driving that?
Sure. Well, if we go back to early 2020, when the pandemic hit, the expectation was that economics would take a hit. So sawmills curtailed production, and they, of course, were also dealing with their own COVID outbreaks, meaning that they had less staff. And so sawmills did not have much lumber inventory. But then borrowing rates were dropped to rock bottom levels. A lot of people were able to work remotely from home. They no longer had to be in their small condos in a city. If they could afford it, they could build a house in the suburbs or out of town a little bit. And a housing boom took place. Everyone started having houses built. Other people started doing their own renovations in their own home. And this, it just shot up demand for lumber. So the market behaved as commodity markets do. When there's strong demand and low supply, prices go up. But they just kept going up, and people just kept building more and more houses. And prices went to levels that analysts who I speak to never saw coming. And finally, just in May, on the futures market, they rose to an all-time record high above $1,700 per square board feet. Per thousand board
right,
feet.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be a very, very
wow.
expensive.
Yeah.
Yes, and so now the futures market has come down, and of course that indicates future delivery. So that's a little bit ahead of what you would actually see at the store. So futures prices have come down 60% from their highs already. They're trading around $650, $700, and prices are starting to come down at lumber yards, at retail outlets as well. But everyone expects that these prices will still remain elevated. So prices are a lot lower they'll probably bounce around, but they are not expected to go back down to pre-pandemic levels for some time.
And Sarah, we just heard from Habitat for Humanity here in Wisconsin, in Green Bay in this case. You talk to organizations involved in building affordable housing around the country. What kind of stories were you hearing?
Yeah, so I mean, the dynamic that Marcy described has been really hard on affordable housing developers who already have to deal with a really complicated financing system and who have already been strained in terms of overheads and margins. Affordable housing production has not kept up with need, and this is only adding another wrinkle to that. I spoke with a Native Partnership for Housing, which builds low-cost homes on reservations in Arizona so that Native American communities can stay on their tribes and won't have to leave in search of cheaper housing outside of those communities. Lumber prices alone lifted construction costs for them by up to $34,000 per single-family home. Costs for fixtures like bathtubs have doubled. And there's just been a lot of tense negotiations with builders and with suppliers to help keep those margins low. I've also talked to folks in building in on the West Coast, in California, in Oregon. They haven't had to cancel any projects entirely, though I've seen anecdotally that that's been the case. But it's they've been having to take on higher contingencies than ever. And long term, they're afraid that this will mean that fewer units will be able to come on the market for higher costs.
We're talking to Marcy Nicholson of Bloomberg and Sarah Holder of Bloomberg's City Lab. They're with us to talk about the increasing cost of lumber and other materials and how it's making difficult for organizations like Habitat for Humanity to build affordable housing for low-income families. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the increase in the price of building materials? Do you have an experience to share with your own house or your own quest for a house? Or if you are a builder, what are you seeing? How is this affecting the costs of the work that you do? And are you having trouble finding affordable housing in your neck of the woods? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the high cost of lumber and its impact on organizations that build low-income housing. Our guests are Marcy Nicholson of Bloomberg and Sarah Holder of Bloomberg's City Lab. They co-wrote a piece on this issue, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the cost of lumber, why it went up so much, or other building materials? And is it affecting your life in your own home or in your work? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to a caller now. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Brian?
Thanks for taking my call. It's a fantastic show.
Thanks.
Well, I'm actually currently in the process of building a home, and our building budget has gone off the charts. It's probably about $40,000 over budget right now due to lumber prices and materials. We're also experiencing the problem with getting materials, so won't be able to move in on time, et cetera. So I'm wondering if your guest has any idea of when this might be turning around for the consumer, to get the lower prices and so on.
Brian, thanks a lot for the call. If it's any consolation, you are not alone, I think, in your experience. Marcy, when might somebody building their own home like Brian see significant downturns in those prices? Any idea?
That really is the million-dollar question right now. Well, I can say that sawmills are ramping up production. We've seen hundreds of millions of dollars of investment by these companies into expanding their production. So there should be long-term more lumber coming online, and we're seeing prices come down. So it does seem like the major part of that rally is over. Do-it-yourself renovations are down, meaning that there's less purchases from big box stores. And so that wood is now available at the wholesale level for home builders like yourself. I think one thing that a lot of people are unaware of is that if you remember that winter storm in Texas in February, that actually affected a lot of building materials because they make a lot of chemicals that go into things like paint. They make the plastic that goes into the piping that goes into the house. And so there was a supply disruption there, and that's what caused a shortage there, as well as the price increase. So that should be working through, and it should be getting better. I think it's going to be a bit of a slow go.
Brian, thanks for the call, and good luck to you. And Sarah, Brian mentioned not just, how much is it going to cost? It's, am I going to get anything, or when is it going to come? Is that something you run into with the Habitat for Humanity type organizations? Even if they could afford the material, was it available when they needed it for a project?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, speaking with folks building in the Navajo Nation, for example, that's a rural community. It's already hard to get materials there. And people have been having to drive, 5-8 hours to get materials that have already taken, 6 to 8 weeks to wait for because of some of these shortages, as you mentioned, not just the expenses. David Logan, a National Association of Home Builders economist, told me that he was talking to people who would, start driving out in the middle of the night once they heard that a shipment of materials had arrived in a neighboring state. So there have been some really crazy waiting periods and strategic moves that people have had to make to contend with this market. And it's not just, these lumber shortages. It's not just these material shortage. There's already some issues with the trucking supply chains, and there are labor shortages, as Marcy mentioned. And so some sources say, total equilibrium in this market might not be reached in the next year.
Let's go now to James on the line in Empire, Michigan. James, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I own a 50-acre sustainable tree farm, and I figured I'll be building there, and I ordered a sawmill, and they told me I'll get my sawmill in about 5 or 6 months.
Ooh.
So I've been waiting already 2 months, so I'll get it this winter. And it's just a shortage of everything all over the place.
Wow, James, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck in getting that up and running. And Marcy, I guess there's probably a lot of competition for people who want, the equipment to process timber into lumber as James wants to.
Well, I have to say this is actually the first time I've heard someone say they actually were trying to buy sawmill equipment. So I think that when you get that, you will have a lot of work on your hands. And I wish you a lot of luck in receiving that shipment.
James, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. At 800-642-1234. We're talking to Marcy Nicholson and Sarah Holder with Bloomberg News, looking at their reporting on the high cost of building materials and how it is affecting nonprofits that help with low-income housing. And that's just part of a big affordable housing picture. Back to your calls now. Tim is with us in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, two things. First of all, I sold a home near Wales, Wisconsin a couple of years ago, and I was going to build a home on a lot I have in Janesville. Now, I worked at Home Depot part-time until I moved, and I can tell you that 2 years ago in July, about this time, the plywood market bottomed out. You could buy a sheet of OSB 7/16 for $4.82. That same sheet of plywood at Menards rate today is about $55,
wow.
Believe it or not. That's how much it's radically changed. Now, I've held off, but I know that I've been in the wood business for a lot of times in the construction trades, and I know that a lot of the softwoods in this country, the market is based on Canadian production. So I want to ask your guests how the Canadian production or the Canadian market is affecting prices in the United States right now.
Ooh, well, let's go right to Canada with Marcy. You're based in Canada, I believe, Marcy. Do you have an answer for Tim?
That's right. That's a really interesting question. And at the moment, in British Columbia, which is the province that accounts for most of Canada's softwood lumber exports to the U.S., there are more than 300 wildfires raging right now, many of them out of control. But production in Canada has actually been on the downtrend, in part because of the number of wildfires that have decreased lumber production, and also the pine beetle infestation, which destroyed millions of hectares of trees. So surprisingly, the lumber coming from Western Canada is more expensive than in the US, and that's partly because of the type of wood it is. But it is on the decrease, and it is more expensive. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're running short on time, Sarah, but I wanted to ask you, we've got a caller who was saying she's homeless, and this is all making it even harder for her as she hunts for housing. When you talk to these nonprofit groups, I mean, did they talk about the demand side, high housing costs, maybe bringing more people to them for help to find a house?
That's a really important point. I mean, especially as we're approaching the end of the eviction moratorium, and folks have been waiting to receive rent relief from the federal government, from the state, from the localities. A lot of people are really struggling right now, and some people are thousands of dollars in debt, if not homeless already. Given this unprecedented demand and some of the job loss and income inequality fostered by the pandemic, it's a time where, yeah, demand for affordable housing and availability of affordable housing is more important than ever. So it's really hitting affordable housing developers at a crunch moment.
And just very briefly, Sarah, did the affordable housing builders you talked to feel like there was light at the end of the tunnel here?
Well, I think the hopeful aspect was that people have not just the two companies I spoke to have not canceled any projects. They take so long to get these designed, financed, approved, and built that just one 6-month period of these volatile prices have not stopped anything in their tracks. I think the fear is that if this goes on for longer, there will be more long-term ramifications. But the hope is that, as Marcy said, prices will come down. That will eventually be reflected at the lumber yards. And some of these long-term projects will be able to get back to within budget.
We'll leave it there. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Marcy, thanks for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
Marcy Nicholson is a reporter for Bloomberg based in Canada, and Sarah Holder is a writer for Bloomberg's City Lab, where she writes about urban politics, housing, and work. They join us today to talk about their recent piece, Pricey Lumber is Making It Harder to Build Low-Income Homes. You can find a link to that article over at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we'll look at why so many Americans distrust the media and what can be done to restore that trust. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin has some big solar energy projects in the works. Get the latest on those and other big stories in energy production here in the state. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, there have been surveys over the years showing that Americans aren't all that trusting of the news media. And here's a new one out from the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism at Oxford. It measures not only the lack of trust here in the U.S., but compares it with how the rest of the world feels about their media. Not doing so hot. And our next guest says he's not surprised. Only 29% of Americans say they trust the news. That's last among 46 countries surveyed. We're right behind France, Hungary, and Slovakia. Finland topped out at 65%. Our neighbors in Canada came in at 45%. So why is trust in the American media so low, and what would it take to bring it back up? You can answer those questions at 800-642-1234. Do you generally trust the news or not? Where do you get your news? And if we ask you a general question about the news media, do you have some you like, some you don't trust? Is it hard to trust the whole thing? What needs to change, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jesse Holcomb is an assistant professor of journalism and communications at Calvin University. He's also been an advisor on Gallup Knight Foundation surveys on trust in the media. That's a different survey than this one from the Reuters Institute. Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's good to be here with you, Rob.
I imagine a lot of people aren't necessarily too surprised to hear numbers like this. You aren't either. I understand why not.
Well, America's trust problem in the news is neither a new one, and actually, nor is it confined to news. We've been looking at these kinds of data for a long time. The Reuters Institute confirms what we've been seeing. We see it with the Gallup polls, and in my decade with the Pew Research Center, we also saw similar trends. Trust in news has been on the decline for decades. It really reached its high watermark in the 1970s, around the Watergate era, where it peaked out in the around 70%, and it's been more or less on the decline ever since. And like I said, it's not just confined to news. We see a broader distrust growing toward American institutions as well. In fact, Congress and the U.S. government is one of those institutions that actually does get lower marks than the news media, but we see it elsewhere too. It's a broader really global phenomenon.
But with this global phenomenon, is when we compare ourselves to the rest of the globe, when it comes to trust in the media in particular now, at least in this Reuters survey, I would have thought, okay, maybe this is something that's going on everywhere. We stand out. We are last among at least these 46 countries surveyed. Why do you think trust in media would be so much lower in the U.S. than in so many other nations around the world?
Well, this survey finding is, so it's about one thing, trust in media, right. But there are, and I can count them, at least four, maybe five stories I can tell that help explain how we got here. Here in the U.S., we're reaping the fruits of decades, really, of political elites and even media elites telling us that the news is untrustworthy. And we see this especially on the right end of the spectrum, which is where you will see most of that trust decline come from. So you couple that with increased and acute political polarization, right? That's with the right side of the spectrum growing, the left side of the spectrum growing, less in the middle. And you add to that this rapid proliferation of media sources. This is one thing we've seen over the past 20 years or so. Now, when people think of the media, they're not just thinking about CBS News and Walter Cronkite. They might be thinking about Facebook, CNN, their local paper. They might be thinking about an influencer that wouldn't be considered a journalist at all. So that's going to play into this change in trust. And again, I would reinforce that broader cultural context decline in trust in institutions. And for many years, Americans have, for whatever reason, and I can point to a number of them, felt like their institutions are really just not serving them all that well. You think of it in terms of banking or religious institutions. And we see the same thing with the news media, which has really been hit by a lot of other broader economic factors, too.
I wonder, with all the possible media sources, you just mentioned a few of them, if someone is asked, do you trust the media, they might think, well, I like, you know, this cable news channel, but not that newspaper or vice versa or what have you. So I guess composite, I don't trust the media. Is that, do you think, what's leading to some of these answers?
It's possible. And it's always worth taking a step back and remembering that survey data give us a little insight into public opinion and how people are thinking. But there are also limits to any specific survey question. So it's worth thinking about other kinds of research that have tried to understand and unpack this trust question as well. For instance, there's other research out there that asks people, well, what do you think about the media that you use, your favorite sources of news? Oh, well, of course, with those questions, you see more people saying that, oh, I trust that. I trust my media, of course. Or you ask them, well, what about the local news media in your own community? There you're going to see higher levels of trust too. The problem is when you ask people their views on the media, all kinds of things could come to mind. And in fact, that's been studied, too. When you ask people what comes to mind when you think of the media, lots of times the first thing that pops into someone's head is going to be a radio talk show host or maybe one of the well-known personalities on cable news. And when you, you know, no disrespect to any of them, but when you get something like that in your head, you might think of the kind of angry, shouty, sometimes exaggerated discourse that doesn't reflect really all that the news media do.
We're talking to Jesse Holcomb, assistant professor of journalism and communications at Calvin University, looking at trust in media or lack thereof here in the United States in particular, according to a recent Reuters survey, some of the causes of that, possible solutions too. And you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jesse, flipping things around for a news organization that isn't, you know, an avowedly partisan news organization that is looking at these numbers and says, well, we want people to kind of trust us. What do we know what kind of things they can do, steps they can take to reconnect with their audience or potential audience?
Absolutely. And my message to news publishers and news organizations around the country is that they can really see this data as an opportunity. Even if those Watergate era trust levels may never fully be recovered, it's important at this point to absorb this information and instead of retrenching and getting defensive, instead lean in and really try to better understand what it is that your audience needs. And it's really important, too, to make sure that newsrooms are becoming more reflective of the communities that they serve. There's a reflection in the data of some dissatisfaction with coverage, especially views about how certain specific communities are covered by the news media, especially communities of color. And that's a critique that, to be perfectly frank, is very well deserved. Other groups, young people as well, feel that the news media either doesn't get them, doesn't cover them accurately, doesn't represent them well. And a lot of that has to do with really the composition of these newsrooms. And for many years, there wasn't a lot of choice. We had a handful of news sources that we used, maybe your local paper and broadcaster, national television news. Well, now with more choices, well, that means more power goes to the audience, and that audience can really speak back. And what we're hearing is that the news media really have to do a better job. For many years, they could kind of take that audience for granted, you know, given the way the sort of market was set up. Publishers can no longer afford to do that. And I would say we are seeing increasingly more signs of news publishers that are really trying to listen, to understand, to diversify from the leadership on down through the reporting ranks. And that's a good thing.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jack is with us in Caledonia. Jack, hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing today? Yeah, this is an interesting topic. You know, bias in the media, you have that on both sides, okay? And people don't trust either of it for the most part because they all, you know, people realize that a certain news outlet is favoring one side of the aisle or the other. The other thing is getting the news out first usually leads to getting information wrong. Okay, and so people are, you know, are dealing with that. I mean, today in Caledonia, we had a terrible shooting, and a lot of the news reports, the reporters are saying, we don't have all the information, but here's what we know. Okay, and so they're being honest about, you know, we don't have all the information, but here's what we do know. And then the other thing is, you know, why do news agencies report specific stories? Okay, the one that comes to my mind is the Russian collusion story. Why was that a daily conversation on you know, CNN News, MSNBC, where they had a lot of past government officials coming in and, you know, stating that they saw evidence of Russian collusion when they talked behind at closed hearings, that they said there wasn't any, but when they came out to the public view, you know, for the public to hear, that they said, no, there's Russian collusion evidence, and I've seen it. Okay,
I mean, Jack, thanks a lot. You've given us a lot to work with there. Let's talk about that first point first, though. Jack, saying on various sides, different outlets have either a real bias or perceived bias. Your thoughts on that, Jesse?
Well, thanks, Jack, for the question and the point. And that, to be sure, is reflected in all kinds of survey data. perceptions of bias by Americans on the left and the right about the media. And what I would say to the bias accusation, and I think I want to really clue in on something that Jack mentioned, which is that there's not just one type of bias that we're talking about, the kind of sort of left-right political bias that we tend to think of first. News organizations, they're made up of human beings that have their own sets of predispositions and life experiences and backgrounds, and they bring that to their work. And so there's all kinds of routines and norms and yes, biases that occur inside newsrooms, for one, that dictate what counts as news and what doesn't. Those are judgment calls. And I would also say, to the point about the bias towards speed and being first and breaking news, that's a very real thing. And Jack is right that mistakes too often get made when there's this sort of rush to be first. That's a bias too. Another one I can think of is that tendency toward wanting to always cover conflict or something negative about a community. We see that a lot too. And we see American publics sometimes just kind of fed up with that. And as a result, we see people, what we call news avoiders, people disenchanted with the news media and sort of tuning out altogether. And what I would say is that I understand the tendency to want to do that, to tune out or just to throw up your hands and say, well, they're all just biased one way or the other. But I would say that our call as citizens is really to not just tune out, but to really engage with the news and to ask those questions, to really listen and pay attention, and to really to ask our news organizations to do better, to be part of that community. It's important, like I said, news leaders are spending more time listening, and it's important to speak up with what's really going on in your mind. But there's more than one type of bias. It happens. It's judgment. And I think what we need to see more of now, and what we are seeing more of, is news leaders and editors being more transparent about where they're coming from. We'll never be able to entirely eradicate point of view or perceptions or our own personal experiences from the journalistic process. That would be ridiculous. But to be honest and transparent about news values and about judgments, that will go a long way, I think, toward at least rebuilding some of that trust.
We're talking about why Americans distrust the media and what could be done to restore that bond. Jesse Holcomb is with us, assistant professor of journalism and communications at Calvin University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you trust the media? What do you think of when I say the media? Which sources do you trust most or least? Do you have thoughts on how maybe your local news outlet could do a better job of serving you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the lack of trust in the media. A new Reuters Institute survey shows that less than a third of Americans say they trust the media. That's last out of 46 countries. Jesse Holcomb stays with us, assistant professor of journalism and communications at Calvin University. He works on Gallup Knight Foundation surveys on trust in the media. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, ideas, solutions, and or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Lynn is with us in Green Bay. Lynn, hi.
Hi. I've got a question. Why hasn't there been a push to bring back the fairness doctrine to help bring back some of that integrity that we started losing in the 1970s?
Lynn, thanks for the call. So, Jesse, the Fairness Doctrine, an old law, a regulation that said you've got to present different sides, different perspectives on politics. Can you remind us how that worked and why it's gone?
Right. Thank you for that. So this was, more than half a century ago that, as you state, was really designed to push. I mean, this was at a time when the broadcast era was still kind of new. And it was very dominant. And there is this concern that these broadcasters would have so much power that and to use those public airwaves should really be required to make sure that their work was done in a way that was honest and transparent and that provided a perspective, a wide range of perspectives. And over time, that I believe that the Fairness Doctrine was eliminated during the Reagan era. There was a sort of period of deregulation. And what we've seen over the past, 30, 40 years or so is, an increase in the range of broadcast, not just broadcasters, but with cable television and then the consumer internet, many more sources of news and information. Broadcast news no longer the only dominant source of news, although I should say broadcast is still a pretty important source of news for many Americans. Right now, I would say the conversation really is starting to turn at a policy level towards what is to be done about the large social platforms. So that's where you're going to see a lot of energy right now in terms of, and it might feel like a familiar tale, the increasing power of companies like Facebook and to some extent Twitter and others in being complicit in or shaping or in some way engineering the public conversation. This is where you've seen these concerns about things like false information, misinformation, and fake news come into play. So there's a lot of discussion about that on Capitol Hill, too, about whether those should be regulated in some similar way, as was done with the Fairness Doctrine by the FCC. And I say without, offering some viewpoint of my own about what kinds of regulations are required or necessary, I do believe that the concerns about misinformation and the editorial role or lack thereof by these social platforms is definitely something that we need to really come to terms with as a society. But more deeply, the bigger political trends that are sort of an undercurrent that sort of give life to those concerning trends that we see on social media.
Time for one more caller. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Howdy. I've been following the news and for years and public radio since maybe the 80s. So anyway, and I've watched the news cycles and I'll be real quick. What's happening in Cuba? Failed state, the economy. They've been under U.S. sanctions and we've threatened the rest of the world not to do business with them. So that what do you expect when you have a major country against a small country? Same thing in Venezuela and all those children and their mothers and so on and so forth. I'm a whining liberal, but you know what? That's the fact. And what's happening,
Mike,
in Iran.
I'm going to jump in because we just have a minute or so left. But Jesse, Mike bringing up issues of context. We often see the headlines, the dramatic pictures. Can the media do more to give background on those or other issues?
They absolutely can, but I should also, again, point to a lot of the survey data we have that show Americans tend to have news interest that sort of goes in one direction but not another. So the news media can do a lot, but at the end of the day, it's also going to be on all of us to essentially vote or march with our eyeballs and really make sure we're paying attention to what's happening around the world. Right now, we're seeing more Americans pay tons of attention to what's happening in national politics here in the United States. Meanwhile, less concern or interest or knowledge of what's happening in our local communities, and also less interest, knowledge, and concern about what's happening in other parts of the world. And to me, that's a concerning development that I would like to see change.
Jesse, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It was a pleasure.
That was Jesse Holcomb, assistant professor of journalism and communications at Calvin University. We talked to him today about Americans' distrust of the media. A new Reuters report, a survey of a bunch of countries, showed that only 29% of people surveyed in the U.S. say they trust the news, and that was the lowest mark among the 46 countries surveyed. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the COVID pandemic has had a big impact on everyone, but in particular on the lives of women. We'll look at a new survey of women in northeastern Wisconsin and then find out how they fit into the big picture, and you can share your experiences along the way. And some of the wealthiest people in the world are traveling up into the Earth's orbit. We'll find out why that is, what it means for the future of spaceflight, and you can join in, tell us if money were no object, if you'd want to do it, and if you think that's a good thing to spend money on. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Here's a story from across the pond in this case being Lake Michigan. As reported in the Detroit Free Press, a man in Muskegon County, Michigan, was working on a demolition project, tearing down the back steps of his house. And after breaking into the concrete, he saw a strange black sphere. On closer examination, it turned out to be a bowling ball. Digging further, he found another one. And another one. The final tally, 160 bowling balls buried under the steps and porch. They were not, by the way, in playable condition. Well, he did some research, contacting the Brunswick Company, famous makers of bowling balls, and makers of these in particular. They were made back in the 1950s, it turns out, and are safe and non-toxic. Turns out that there used to be a Brunswick bowling ball factory in Muskegon, and workers would often take home scrap or defective bowling balls to use as fill in place of sand or gravel. So, mystery solved, and we learned when you start digging into things, you never know what you might strike. Don't worry, I'll spare you the bowling puns, even though that kind of thing is right up my alley. Because if I get on a roll, the producers here will split. You already think I'm kind of a turkey. So let's put a pin in it for now. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.